Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and today we have a subject that, well, when I read this book, The Road Out of Hell, about Sanford Clark and the true story of the Wineville murders, in fact, this story was behind the movie Changeling, I just was astonished and amazed. This is a book that when you're reading it, you live it when you're reading it. And you may end up with a queasy stomach, but by the time you're finished, you'll realize that there is so much behind this story that Anthony, along with Jerry Clark, they were able to put together. I want to welcome Anthony Flacco, who is in the Seattle area. Anthony, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Don. I'm glad to be here with you today.
Now, you have been writing for a long time. You've been a ghostwriter, a screenwriter. You've been involved in public speaking. You've done previously historical crime novels. And you, with Jerry Clark, who is the oldest son of the subject of this story, Sanford Clark, the two of you got together. How in the world did you ever make a connection with this man? I think this story is just so phenomenal. It's a time frame that is in 1928, about that time frame. How did the two of you connect?
Well, this was something that the story was just going to die away with Jerry's generation, except for when the movie Changeling came out. His father, Sanford Clark, is a character in the movie, but he only comes in at the end. They don't tell you much about him. And Jerry was very upset that it left people with the impression that he was some kind of a co-conspirator with the murderer, Gordon Northcott, which he was certainly not. He was a captive victim. And so he started looking around to want to get his father's story done, and he contacted me through my agent, Charlene Martin. And she asked, told me about the story, said, do you want to do this? And I said, no, murders of little boys, it's an old case. No, I don't want to do it. But Jerry was persistent, and he kept getting in touch with her, and she kept saying, look, this guy's not leaving me alone. Maybe you'd better just have a talk with him.
Mm-hmm.
So I called him up, and I just said, Jerry, what is it that you think a book is going to do after all these years? Why are you so intense about this? And he said, well, just let me tell you about my dad. And he started telling me about his father and who he had grown up to be after this torturous years that he spent trapped on the murder farm. And he grew up to be this wonderful, exemplary human being who was a war hero and a beloved local figure and married to the same woman for 55 years and respected by the community, even though they were all fully aware of his past. And when Jerry sent me a few articles verifying that what he was saying was true, that's what caught my interest, because I thought, random awful things can happen to anyone. But when you are able to recover with such to a stellar extent that he did, I get very curious. I want to know how that happened, because I think that's where the wisdom in a story like this lies. You know, God forbid any of us should ever find this kind of evil dumped into our laps, but we all suffer lesser encounters with evil, and we have to survive and get past those. And I think seeing how people who had it much worse are able to do it can really be instructive and inspiring and reinforcing. And that's ultimately what I think this book can do, although I know the parts where the young boys trapped on that murder ranch, they're tough. The reality of it
really
is tough.
Yeah, your investigative journalism has just been terrific. Now, you have a foreword in the book by Dr. Michael Stone.
Yes.
And this man is the host of Discovery Channel's Most Evil. He's the professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons and also attending psychiatrist in forensics at Mid-Hudson Forensic Psychiatric Hospital. Now, his foreword, I found, was absolutely amazing, because this is a man who obviously has encountered so many things of such a vile nature that, by the grace of God, most of us don't, thank heavens. I mean, it's just really, really hideous stuff I know this man has had to encounter. But as a professional, he is able to look at it and to deal with it. And he said, Gordon Stewart Northcott, who is the uncle, who is the real worst personification of human character you'd ever want to have on this planet.
Yeah, I can't think of a worse example, actually.
Oh, he was just, just amazingly hideous. And the nephew, Sanford, he was 7 years older than his nephew. And the stuff he did was just terrific. But Dr. Stone said that the uncle, Gordon, he said he was a psychopath.
Oh, absolutely.
A sadistic psychopath. And he said it's the sadism that adds the quality, and this is the key feature, of enjoying the suffering of others.
Yes.
You know, I've interviewed people that have survived Auschwitz, and they'll talk about certain individuals who were of this dispositioning. And I've talked to Russians who went through Stalin's horrific years. I've talked to people that are from, you know, Pakistan, Pol Pot. You have these, and in Africa, things that are done. I mean, you go, my Lord, why aren't these people held accountable? I mean, it's just amazing. But Dr. Stone does such a wonderful job with the foreword. How did the two of you connect?
Let's see. I had gone to him early in the writing of the book, wanting to consult with him about some of the symptoms that Gordon Northcott displayed. And he was already aware of the case. He's got voluminous files in his office in New York City. I mean, they line the walls of his office, hundreds of these cases that he's studied to try to understand the nature of evil in the human mind, physically how it affects the brain, as well as, you know, abstractly how it affects the personality. And he got very interested, and we had so many great discussions, and he was so insightful, I finally just dared to ask him. I said, Doctor, would you be willing to read the book before I submit it to the publishers and write a foreword? And he said, yeah, sure, I'd be glad to. And then he read it, and he wrote that wonderful foreword that he did that I'm so complimentary, and I'm grateful for it, particularly after having been in his office in New York and seen the decades of study and the manuscripts he's got on this topic. This man, and his ability, his memory's phenomenal. I sat down at dinner with him, and he could discuss dozens and dozens of cases going back decades in time and pull up names and dates and figures and facts. He's like a human encyclopedia. Very impressive guy. So when he gave the foreword such a wonderful slant that he did, of course, I was delighted, and so was the publisher. We're very grateful to him.
I agree. Now, both the uncle and the nephew, he said, and I'm quoting directly from your book, in addition to having a fourth of their blood in common, both of them had mothers who were abusive, unscrupulous viragos. Both had fathers who were tyrannized by their wives and indifferent towards their children. Now,
Yes. What
is so fascinating, and I've known of cases like this before, you will have families like this that are just nightmares from hell, and yet there will be maybe certain members that are just as virulent and vile as they are, and yet others just are totally the opposite, just like Stanford was. It's just absolutely amazing, and that you can't explain it. There's no real logic to it. It's a fascinating phenomenon.
Right, and it's one of the things that Dr. Stone studies is trying to figure out when you have, you know, brothers and sisters, and one is evil and the other person grows up good, but they had basically the same experience of childhood. This raises the question, well, where does that come from? Because I don't think anyone today believes our personalities are strictly controlled by nurture, by our DNA. Our environment does have an effect. So it's a baffling question. No one's really gotten to the bottom of it yet. But Stanford himself was so worried about, he didn't have kids of his own. He adopted two boys, he and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to the local orphanage and adopted their so-called hard-to-adopt boys. These were boys who were older boys who had already been through foster homes and bounced around and were having difficulties. And generally, at that stage, they stay in the institution for the rest of their lives and until they're grown up and can get away because people won't take them.
Mm-hmm.
And he took two. And one of them, Jerry Clark, is the one who was so intent upon celebrating his father. And to Jerry's credit, I should say, even though his name is on the byline here, I wrote the whole book, and Jerry didn't ask me or demand in any way that his name be included on it either. I put it there because, although I did write the book myself, I never could have done this without Jerry Clark and the keys he gave me into his father's mind. Because as far as I'm concerned, if you can't get into Sanford Clark's mind, the story isn't worth telling. It's
mm-hmm.
just too awful. But if you can get into his mind, and if the reader will stay with you during his terrible time on the murder farm, then you also get to be in his mind as he recovers and goes on and lives this exemplary life.
Yes,
and that, to me, is what makes this story worth telling, and beyond simply being a horror show of something that a madman did.
Right. That's very, very true. Now, what's so fascinating about Jerry is that his dad was a part of that generation where people didn't talk.
Yes.
People would not say anything. Now, some of that goes on today, but in today's society, we're more open in some respects than in the past. But in the early 1900s, it was not something that you would talk about, certain things. And Jerry, though he had been adopted, he was 17 when his dad said, I've got to tell you some things.
Yeah.
And in that period of time when his father was talking to him, he literally grew up. He became a man in his own mind. I mean, it totally transformed his life.
Overnight. Overnight.
Yeah, just overnight.
And as Stephen said in the book, his father only told him because there had been another murder in their neighborhood, and he was afraid that when the reporters started swarming around, someone would dig up his past, and he didn't want some reporter collaring his son on the schoolyard somewhere out on the
mm-hmm.
street. So he took him aside one night. They're on their way to a hockey game, and he pulled over and left the car running and said, look, there's something I have to tell you. I'm going to talk about this once. I don't ever want to tell you or talk about it again. But they sat there for hours, and he told him the full story of the Wineville murders from the time he was kidnapped at the age of 13 in Canada, driven down to Southern California out in the desert, and held captive there for 2 years by his uncle while his uncle went on this horrendous murder spree. And it's interesting that even though there was only just under 8 years difference between Sanford and his uncle,
mm-hmm.
His uncle was an adult, was a young adult, you know, free and on his own, and Sanford was a 13-year-old as a boy, utterly dependent. And that is really what's salient about their relationship, not that they were so close in age, but that one was an adult with his own car and his own money and his own ranch, and the other was a boy utterly dependent on him. Who was sold out by his mother and sent down to that ranch, even though his mother already knew that her brother was a pedophile and that
mm-hmm.
she was sending her son away to be with a pedophile, and then basically ignored him for 2 years while he was stuck down there. And in this awful environment, this boy, isolated on this murder ranch out in the desert, is forced to participate in these crimes and help destroy the bodies and bury the remains and all this awful stuff. And so it does beg the question, how did he recover? Because if he had been rescued after 2 years and gone on to have some horrible life and become an alcoholic or something, we would all go, well, sure, yeah,
mm-hmm.
that's what you'd expect. But instead, when he comes on and is this wonderful civic figure embraced by the people who know full well what his past is, this is what raises the question of how did he do it. Especially, he was not of the generation like the way my dad was. He could bury something that upset him, and I really think he didn't feel it or think it once he buried it.
Mm-hmm.
Sanford was not that way. He was tormented consciously by these memories every day for the rest of his life. He also physically had difficulties for the rest of his life because of all the rapes that he had endured personally as well. And so this was never far from his mind. It was always right there. And yet he was able to put on this comforting and consoling face. He was a mail carrier after he got out of the war for 28 years, and everybody along his route loved him. He was a docent at the local museum, the Western Development Museum up in Saskatchewan, and a respected figure there, and yet all the time carrying this torment inside. People would talk about it. He would talk to anybody. He was interested. He wanted to know what they were doing. He was a compassionate, involved person. And this is what makes it fascinating to me. I don't understand. How did he not grow up to be some bitter old man, isolated mm-hmm. out in the woods, you know, not wanting to talk to anybody? I'd have understood if that had been his fate. And I'm humbled by this guy. I'm humbled by who he became. And that's the most instructive thing that's come to me from writing this book, aside from trying to recover from the emotional difficulty of identifying with this boy's plight, has been the humbling effect of seeing what a great spirit can do with even the worst of things getting dumped on you, on your life.
I agree.
Like everyone else, I don't know what the future holds in store for me. You know, God forbid it's something that awful. But if it is, I do have something now. I have the knowledge that it can be done. That he wasn't some Superman. He wasn't particularly well-educated. He wasn't a brilliant person. This guy could have been anybody. He could have been the guy sitting next to you in a coffee shop. And so if he can do it, I can do it, and you can do it. And that's the wonderful thing about this. Like I said, I hope nobody listening here ever finds this level of evil dropped into their life, but we all know we're going to have some level of it. And the more we see that it can be coped with successfully, that you don't have to be traumatized over mm-hmm. these things, the better it is for all of us.
I agree. Now, a very significant person, his mother, like you said, put him into this environment willingly.
Yeah.
She was just a horrific person.
I don't place her anywhere above the killer himself.
That's right. She was just as bad as he was.
Yes.
And her husband didn't really fight against her, and what, even though he knew what she was doing was wrong. So he didn't stand up for his son. Also, the grandmother, his grandmother, and
who was also just as ravingly psychotic as he was. I mean, it was a real piece of work, this family.
I mean, this family was unbelievable. But Jessica, his sister, I was really moved by the fact that she knew something was wrong. She was older than her brother. I don't remember how many years, but she determined when he was sent away, she's going to get him back. And she challenged Northcutt, and her life was in jeopardy. And
she was a wonderful, I wish I had met Jessie. She's passed away some years ago. I'd love to have met her. What a woman she was. She was only 19 when she finally went to her parents and said, look, Sanford's been gone for 2 years. These letters that are coming home, they don't sound like they were written by him. I know it's his handwriting, but something's wrong. And the parents kept saying, oh, you know, shut up, leave it alone. She finally went, earned the extra money for herself, got a ticket to come all the way from Saskatchewan, Canada, all the way down to Southern California. This is 1928. It's a 19-year-old woman making that journey alone. Once she got out to the ranch alone, she confronts Uncle Stewart about what's going on. He jumps her and is in the process of strangling her to death when his mother walks in and stops him, not because, oh, you shouldn't do that to somebody, but because they know she's here. You can't possibly get away with this. You have to let her get up. So he let her get up. At that point, she fled the ranch and went to authorities, and that's what ultimately led to getting Sanford rescued and getting off that ranch. But she did all this at the age of 19 by herself,
mm-hmm.
with money she had to earn by herself, taking that long trip down all the way across Canada and then down the coast by steamer. The strength of that woman was phenomenal. And it's like you said earlier, she's from that same family. She had that same crazy blood. But it seemed to be something in their DNA that either you went psychotic or you went to the other spectrum and you became this unshakable kind of person. She and her brother were that way. But the parents, both parents, were just absolute basket cases of human beings.
Yeah, I mean, they should have just been shipped out into outer space, as far as I'm concerned, without
a guys, suit. People like that make a good case for forced sterilization.
It's just hideous. But when they began to realize, when Northcutt and his mother, who assisted him in some of the horrific things that he did, they left Sanford alone. They just took off. They left.
Yes.
They thought they were going to escape. And when the authorities picked up this young man, I mean, he's what, 15?
15 by then, yes.
And he's gone through these horrific situations, and they didn't really believe that this was possible. If it hadn't been for Jesse, they would have just said no, but he said, I'll show you everything you need to know. He was so explicit. And can you imagine what it must have been like for those adult officers to have a young man of 15 who is just stone-faced. I mean, you've got a photo of him after he had been taken into custody. Just the look was like of an animal that had had all of its life essence taken out of it. It was
yes, he had that thousand-yard stare.
Yes, yeah. The thousand-yard stare. And I looked at that photo, and my heart went out to him, and I thought, oh, my goodness, but he was able to tell them everything. And when you hear it coming from a 15-year-old, most of the time you think, oh, people are, you know, kids are exaggerating. They're doing the yada, yada, yada. Not this case. And the more they found out, the worse it got. Talk to us about the man who turned his life into an opportunity instead of being shipped off to prison, because they very easily could have done that with him.
Well, this is a great story for people who believe in angels. The man's name was Loyal Kelly. He was a kind of a freelance adjunct to the prosecutor's office at the time. He worked sometimes as an investigator for them. Other times he worked as a trial attorney for them, but he was just kind of on his own. When he heard about this case, he said he wanted to get involved. And they eventually wound up handing the prosecution of the case to him. And that's when he looked at Sanford, who at that point was incarcerated, and they were going to get him on a conspiracy charge and put him in prison for life.
Right.
And back then, of course, a 15-year-old, if you were put in prison, they threw you right in with the worst of the worst,
mm-hmm.
which meant he would have been the boy toy of the cell block. It would have
right.
finished his destruction. But Loyal Kelly instinctively understood Stockholm Syndrome, even though back then it wasn't even known or recognized. And he said, this boy is not a perpetrator. He's a victim every bit as much as any of the others. He just happens to still be alive. And he managed to calm down the authorities and get them to just do a fairly minor conspiracy charge on Sanford that got him a slap on the wrist sentence of a couple of years in a boys' school as opposed to into the prison. But mm-hmm. he also then stayed on the case and made sure that Sanford was sentenced to the Whittier boys' school and not to the prison, because they had this tremendous forward-thinking program of rehabilitation for young people that was entirely focused on eliminating recidivism. Every question of the day was always, what are you going to do to not come back here? The day was split in half. They spent half the day in classroom studies, the other half in shop learning skills so that they would have a saleable trade. And Sanford soaked up his lessons. And after he got out of there, after 2 years there at the age of 17, he was shipped back up to Canada and turned loose and started alone in life. Of course, he had no family, just mm-hmm. his sister, and built from nothing, working on the skills he'd gotten there and just working as a laborer and working construction until he eventually got himself on his feet. And then the war came along. He joined the war. Was a combat artillery commander, saw action in 5 different theaters of action over in Europe, was decorated a number of times, came home and began a career with the post office, because the Canadian Army back then, if you had served in combat, you were guaranteed a civil service job if you wanted one, which mm-hmm. he took. And he wanted to work outdoors and stuff, so he walked a mail route. And at first, when he came home, people were very suspicious of him, too. They'd read the news reports. And, of course, nobody knew about Stockholm Syndrome or anything. All they knew is you were down in California for 2 years on a ranch where somebody was murdering little boys, and you were helping to bury them, and now you're here and you're our mailman? What is?
Mm-hmm.
He had
mm-hmm.
to overcome tremendous resistance, and yet just by force of his personality, he was gradually accepted and then completely embraced by the community. I mean, that's the thing. The man wasn't just tolerated. This man was loved by dozens and dozens of people, all of whom knew about his past. He didn't hide it. That's what's so phenomenal about him and about his story, and I think about his message. The resilience of a person, even an ordinary Joe like Sanford Clark, the resilience that we have, that all of us have. Fortunately, most of us go through life without ever encountering the need to call upon it fully, but he did. And like I said, it was a humbling lesson for me. I'm going to keep it in my hip pocket as the troubles of life hit me and as things feel like they're just too overwhelming. Because, you know, if he can do it, I can do it. You can do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, let me ask you a question about your research.
All right.
Because obviously you did a lot of it. And
yeah.
His son, Jerry, was able to give you some information. You have some photos in here that are very explicit. Northcutt had to pay his dues eventually.
Yes.
And took a long time for it to happen, but he did. What happened to his mother?
Well, she was jailed on a kind of an offshoot conspiracy charge. She did serve 12 years in prison and then was let go. The laws being what they were at the time and the nature of whatever proof they had about her, they couldn't really rack her up the way she needed. She should have been seen life in prison, if
yeah,
not an executioner
the murder,
herself.
Right.
Yeah. Her son was hung in 1930, which was just a year or two after he was busted on the ranch. But she served 12 years and then was allowed to go free and pretty much was scot-free after that, unfortunately. And Sanford even to some extent took her back into his life. I mean, they were never close buddies, but he didn't divorce himself from her, as you would think, as I would have done, or even his father. I one of the pictures I included in the book shows a card he sent his dad from Europe, when a photo of him as a soldier. And the caption that he wrote on it, you can see his handwriting, says, "To a real swell dad from your loving son." And I thought that was striking and very poignant because, of course, he wasn't a real swell dad in any sense of the word.
Mm-hmm.
But we all have that need. We have a primal need for parenting. We need to have a real swell dad, whether we've got one or not. And this wasn't an expression of fact. It was an expression of hope. It was his way of asking his father to be a real swell dad, you know, which his father never really did. But Sanford gave him the benefit of the doubt. He had that kind of generosity of spirit.
With your research, you had an assistant that really did a lot, you said.
Yes.
But to get all of the details regarding this, did you have to find archives? Where were you able to get the dates, the specifics, all the names? And because this took how much time did it take for you to get all this put together?
Well, I'm a research monster. If you remember the old Pac-Man game,
mm-hmm,
with the little thing about eating the dots, that's me doing research. and so I take every source that I can. Lots of hard copy work in libraries, of course, lots of internet work, lots of book work from related authors, consulting work with professionals. I had two different psychiatrists that I was consulting with on personality on this. Christine Quinn, my researcher, is an author in her own right. She's very anal retentive about detail and a great researcher. And she would compile these huge folders full of material that she would track down for me, as well as going to family members and friends that Jerry Clark provided me with names and contact numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to speak to a number of his friends, fellow employees, employers, a contractor who worked with him, and really get a broad picture of who this man was, not just to Jerry or to a friend, but how that world that he lived in up there perceived him. It isn't just that I found a few people who spoke well of him. I couldn't find any single person with anything negative to say about him. And we all know how people love to gossip. We know that generally, I mean, some people are wonderful and they won't engage in gossip, but most people will.
Mm-hmm.
And if you give them something like that, why, the kind of talk they'll engage in, an evil speculation about how a person is some sick bastard or something. And he overcame all of that.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't that the people up in Saskatchewan, I don't think, are morally any above the rest of us. I think they're just like all of us. It was Sanford who overcame their tendency to, mm-hmm, want to be gossipy and petty and tell little sordid details about things. They just came to see there's this wounded spirit here who is still full of love and goodness, and it humbled them, I think, the way it humbled me to study this, and that the nasty gossipy type people decided maybe they would go gossip about somebody else and leave this man alone.
Well, I found the L. Kelly, the man that opened the door of opportunity for Sanford to have a whole life, who put him in the school and was very supportive of him. One of the most poignant scenes, I think, that you wrote about was when he realized the young man was going to make it. And he shook his hand, and there was this moment between the two of them where Sanford knew that Kelly had to have gone through something himself to have such an understanding of him, and he said, "We just don't, what's been done has been done. We won't go there. We talk about living today." And those are my words summing up the scene in the book. But it portrays so many different sides of human nature, from the vilest to the best.
This man was an absolute angel, and I'm so sorry. I mean, he died many years ago. How I would love to have spoken with him and try to get some sense of where he got his insights. You know, how did he grow up? How did he have... This is 1928 in the middle of the California desert, and the community was so outraged, they stormed the jail en masse, you know, with their flaming torches. They wanted to drag him out and hang him right then, and they would have taken Sanford with him. They had to be stopped. Loyal Kelly was one of the people who had to stop them at gunpoint. That's how outraged the society. Society would have eaten Sanford Clark alive if not for Loyal Kelly. But just as Sanford was apparently doomed by being thrown into hell with this monster, Gordon Clark, for 2 years, he was then alternately blessed by Loyal Kelly. And it was as if the balanced scales of the universe came back and tipped in his favor then, because Loyal Kelly completely changed Sanford's experience of the prosecution on this case, and as you said very well, gave him back his life, literally. Sanford took it and ran with it and never looked back. Well, a true thing that's in this book, and I want people to know, I didn't make this detail up. For the rest of his life, when Sanford was asked his nationality, he would just grin and say, "I'm Irish," which Loyal Kelly was. And clearly he'd never even been to Ireland. But Jerry said it was funny. It became his family joke. You couldn't get him to admit he was Canadian anymore. He'd say, "I'm Irish." Yeah. And, you know, and you'd try to say, no, you were born in Saskatchewan. He would laugh at you and say, "No, I'm Irish." Well, that was his sort of macho, manly way of honoring Loyal Kelly. I'm an Irishman because of him, because in a sense, Kelly fathered this second life that he had, and in many ways was a better father to him than his own dad.
Well, I'll tell you, this book, The Road Out of Hell, is one of the best written stories. It's true. It is something that will grip you in a way that is beyond belief, and I don't know that I would want to say anything more about it. Just go out and get the book, The Road Out of Hell, a true story about Sanford Clark and the true story of the Wineville murders. Anthony Flacco has been my guest. You can go to his website, find out more. Anthony, the last name is spelled F-L-A-C-C-O. Anthony, it has been a joy having you as a guest. And
Thank you, Donna. I'm just in awe
of how you did such phenomenal investigative journalism and told such a story that, well, mirrors a lot of what we need to be attentive to and aware of and be consciously present about life and how we live it and what's going on around us. Thank you again for
being my guest. My pleasure, Donna. Thank you for having me.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break, and we're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away. Anthony Flacco, FLACCO.com. Check it out. We'll be right back.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to DTaP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's T-TAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, ttap.com.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in Physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
The Northwest Women's Show, presented by Assurant Health, is a show that's all about you, your body, your spirit, your life. 400 exhibits, free samples, and best of all, shopping with fabulous Women's Show specials. Meet Amy Roloff from Little People Big World and cosmetic cop Paula Begon. Bring your questions to Hollywood celebrity stylist and creator of Wynn Hair Care Products, Chaz Dean. Make it a point to attend our free seminars and be inspired by topics that can change your life, like channeling your inner strength, weight loss strategies, and women's self-defense. Plus fun and trendy fashion shows from JCPenney. And backed by popular demand, Seattle's hottest firefighters. Favorite authors Anne Rule and J.A. Jantz. The Women's Show, presented by Assurant Health. March 5th through 7th at Quest Field Event Center. Sponsored by Bartell Drugs, American Family Insurance, Puget Sound Energy, Snoqualmie Casino, The Seattle Times, and King 5. For show information, go to nwwomenshow.com. The Northwest Women's Show. It's such a girl thing.
Hi, this is Donna. You've just heard the ad about the Northwest Women's Show. I want to add to that, I'm going to be in booth number 407, and on Friday, March the 5th, I'm going to be hosting and interviewing 6 dynamic women for 3 hours. The first hour, we're going to be talking about money. The second hour, we'll be talking about energy healing. And the third hour, we'll be talking about animals and their well-being. So it's going to be a dynamic 3-hour program. If you have the chance to come out to the Pacific Northwest Women's Show, be sure you stop by the booth 407. And I'm also going to be speaking on your inner psychic mirror on Saturday and Sunday at 11:30. So this is a dynamic event. Go to their website, Northwest Women's Show, that's nwwomenshow.com, and you'll find out about all the details. Look forward to seeing you there. Also, for those of you who are listening from Alaska, I am going to be up in the far north during the month of April. And it looks like the week of the 12th, more information will be coming out in my upcoming newsletter. And lastly, if you have had an experience with a ghost, if you've had any paranormal phenomena that you have experienced that has affected your life in a very meaningful way, I'd love to hear your story. I'm putting together a publication. We're aiming for 100 stories. So I would love to have you send it to me via email, and that's to Donna at DelphiInternational.com. Be sure that you put your contact information in there so that I can be in touch with you. So we're compiling 100 stories to be able to share these stories with other people so they won't feel like they are alone. And I already have started a file, and we are on our way, and I would love to have yours. So again, send it via email, Donna at Delphi International, or if you like, you can put it all together, type it out, whatever you need to do, and send it to me via snail mail to the Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. Well, the telephone lines are now open. If you would like to give me a call, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756 is the telephone number to call into. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about how to make up and not break up. Dr. Bonnie Wheel is going to be my guest. So Valentine's is just around the corner, and I have, well, it might be a little bit of a Kleenex moment that I'm going to share with you, a true story about a wonderful couple and their Valentine celebration. So that I'm going to be coming up with in a little bit. But before I go to that, Many times when we're watching programs on television, if you're like me and you're fascinated with all kinds of things, forensics is really, to me, an amazing area because you have to obviously be very knowledgeable about anatomy, but there are so many unique variables that can occur that's beyond our imagining. And I came across a particular case that I thought I would share with you. And it occurred in 1994. In fact, it was on February 19th of 1994. There were six staff members of a seven-person medical team at Riverside General Hospital who passed out when one of the attendants took a blood sample from a patient. The patient's name was Gloria Ramirez, and she had just gone into cardiac arrest. Now, she had been admitted semi-conscious. She had been, like many times people are in that kind of situation, she was throwing up, she had chest pains, trouble breathing, and there was a, they described it as a slick, oily film that was all over her body. Well, they checked out her medical history, and they found out that she was being treated for cervical cancer and had only been given an anti-nausea drug. She had not yet begun her radiation treatments. Now, this is what happened. They took a syringe to puncture her skin to take her blood when these horrifically strong ammonia-like fumes filled the air, caused six people on this team to pass out. Only one person of this group of seven was not affected, and they to this day, don't know why not. Now, the ambulance individuals, the members of the team there, who brought her to the hospital, were not affected by being around her. And they don't know where these fumes originated from. Well, they evacuated the whole emergency room. Something was going on they didn't understand. Now, the six people that had passed out, they ended up suffering real extreme symptoms. Two of the six had to be put into the hospital, into intensive care. One of the doctors became bedridden with a bone degenerating disease, and another required a ventilator because of erratic breathing. They couldn't breathe. Now, three of the team appeared to have been poisoned by what they determined was a chemical class called organophosphates. Now, when they took the blood samples from the patient, Ramirez, and one of the infected staff members were shown to contain unknown particles of white and yellow crystalline materials, the patient died shortly after entering the hospital. They did an autopsy on her in a very, very specially sealed container in the coroner's area because they didn't want anybody else being affected. They had absolutely no clue what had happened here. And they looked for what they called a nonspecific substance. The body itself, after the autopsy, was later encased in multiple layers of bags and also put into an aluminum casket. Now, what they found when they did a lab analysis was an unidentifiable chemical compound that developed in the bag that her body was in. Also, they found it in air samples that were taken during the autopsy. Now, what they determined is that what she really died from was a kidney failure related to her cancer, but they were never able, to this day, to the best of our knowledge, to figure out what the chemical was that was created by her body and what created the deadly gas that affected six out of seven people in that medical room and why the ambulance drivers were not affected. But it happened after the puncture was made. You just never know. The human body can do some fascinating, fascinating things. Nature is amazing. I mean, when you can go diving in waters and suddenly come in contact in deeper levels of water with an orange-like layer of substance that's just right there suspended in water itself. The water above it is fine, the water below it is fine, but that orange substance is highly toxic and it'll kill you. And it's all microorganisms. Why they do that in that environment, nobody has a clue. It is always going to be challenging. We think we know it all, but I guarantee you we are far from it. Donna Sebo here. If you want to give me a buzz, 888-815-9756. Okay, and I want to also let you know, again, tomorrow we're going to be talking about making up, don't break up, Dr. Bonnie Wheel. We had a great lineup for next week as well. So we'll take a break for just a moment. When we come back, I've got a wonderful love story for you and a little bit of this and a little bit of that. So do stay with me. We'll be back shortly.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Ged Rose. Buy it today. 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Before I share the love story with you that I just think is absolutely wonderful, I want to give you some information about chocolate. To me, it's one of the mandatory foods of life. Absolutely. Did you know you can save money by munching on chocolate? Now, I'm not talking about eating 5 tons of it every day. I'm talking about little bits of nibbles with chocolate. Well, they've done research. I love research studies like this. Before you go shopping, you should enjoy a handful of some chocolate pieces of your favorite choosing. And what you do when you do that, if you're going to go shopping, you have a little bit of chocolate. And they find that nibbling chocolate helps prevent you from falling for snazzy marketing displays or sales that tempt you to purchase things you don't actually need. Oh, that must have been a fun survey to do. This was done at the University of Utah. The researchers say that the credit goes to the amino acid tryptophan, and it is abundant in chocolate. Any excuse to have a chocolate is a good excuse, wouldn't you agree? What it does, tryptophan helps your body produce serotonin, which is a brain chemical that helps curb impulsive spending. Oh, can you imagine standing there looking at a bunch of diamonds? Or a Maserati and nibbling on chocolate, not feeling badly at all, that you just didn't pick it up that afternoon. Ah, yes. I couldn't pass that story up. I just love that. Okay, this is the love story. And to me, it's so special. In today's world, where frequently people do not experience long-time commitments in marriage, when you're able to talk about a couple that have been married for over 40 years, and they're mature in their years, and one of the couple is, well, it's just not faring well. This is a story by Carolyn McKinney, and it's about her mom and dad. And she said it was the day before Valentine's Day when she was looking out of a hospital window just saying, I just wish something could be done for my dad where he could be with us a little bit longer. But her dad was ill, and he was comfortable, but she knew he wasn't going to be there very much longer. And she said, I was not accustomed to the waiting time, familiar to those who have maybe been with a terminally ill loved one. And she said, I found my mind going back to happier times, and every memory that I was recalling, it was always my mom and dad together. And she just got absolutely thrilled. He had a wonderful, wonderful Valentine habit where he would give her flowers and special cards, and she saved every one of the cards that he ever gave her in a special wooden box. She said, my mom, who never, ever would leave my dad's side, had become so exhausted that she had had to go home, and she needed to get some sleep, so I was there. And a nurse walked into the room while Caroline was there and wanted to know how her dad was doing, and she said, I didn't even have to say anything to her. She was checking his pulse. She knew that he wasn't doing too well. And she was chattering. Nurses see this kind of thing every day. And so all of a sudden, the chatter that the nurse was making snapped her out when she said, tomorrow is Valentine's Day. And Carolyn said, oh my goodness, the gift shop is open, and if you want to run down and get a card for Valentine's Day, I'd be happy to sit with your dad. The nurse was just chatting like this. So she said, okay, I'll go down. So she went down to the gift shop, and she was looking at various cards, and she saw ones that said for my father, and she said, well, my dad wouldn't care about Valentine's Day now. And she was looking at all the cards that she would have sent to him when she saw a card that said to my wife on Valentine's Day. And then the memory popped up in her mind. She saw this very special wooden box where her mother, all of her married life, every year, had put the Valentine cards that her husband had given her in. And she said they had been married for almost 40 years. And she said, I bought this card, and I went back to my dad's room. The nurse, I thanked her, and she left. And she said, I leaned over the bed and whispered in my dad's ear, Daddy, you have to do one more thing. She put a pen into his hand and laid the open card on his chest. And she said, Daddy, please, this is for Mom. It's a Valentine. You've never forgotten to give her a Valentine card. So she stepped away from the bed, and she sort of felt badly. She thought, gee, my dad's not doing very well. Why in the world am I doing this? So she got a chair, pulled it as close to the bed as she could, and she just sat down in it, closed her eyes, and she was so exhausted she went to sleep. And she said it was a few hours later she awakened with just the realization she had fallen asleep. And she went to take the pen from her dad's hand, and the Valentine had slipped to one side, and when she reached for the card, she saw her dad's lips move. She leaned forward. She couldn't hear what he said, but there was a trace of a smile, she said, on his face. She picked up the card and looked inside, and there in shaky letters, he had written, Love, Dave. So she whispered in her dad's ear, Thank you, Daddy. Mom will love this. And he managed to raise his fingers, letting her know that he heard what she said. He died 3 hours later, and when her mother entered the room, resting by his pillow, was his last Valentine for her. Miraculously signed by him, because love will always have the last word. Caroline McKinney, thank you for that story. It's just wonderful. You never know. You never know. And love never goes away. Donna Sebo here. I want to let you know, tomorrow again, we're going to be talking about how to make up, not break up, with Dr. Bonnie Leal. And then next week, we're going to be talking with Dr. Williams about the affordability factor. And then also Dr. Swanson on Tuesday. Help, my kids are driving me crazy. Sound a little familiar? Kay Moradian, who has written a book in recognition of her mother's personal experiences. It's called A Gift in the Sunlight. It is about Armenians. And then we're going to talk about the birth and death of the cool. Yes, this is going back to the 60s, to the music, to the styles. It's just a trip down memory lane. And then the full plate diet with Dr. Teresa Sherard. We've got a wonderful lineup, always terrific guests. If you want to know who's coming up, check out on BBS under the Donna Sebo Show, those guest listings and what's happening with them. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna. Keep love in your heart and let it fill the air around you. Talk with you tomorrow, same time, same place. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.